Good morning, everybody. Hope you're doing well. Sylvain Molyneux from Freedom Maine. So it is Mother's Day today, and I hope you have a great relationship with your mother. I hope that if you are a mother, you have a great relationship with your children. And I wanted to spend a couple of minutes talking about motherhood, and just wanted to pause for a special shout out to some dear close family friends who lost their mother recently, and that they are in our thoughts. We will talk later, and lots of love. So, if we could keep the topic to mothers today, that would be appreciated. It's not essential. It would be nice, but it's not essential. So, I wanted to talk about motherhood in particular today, because it's really interesting how little women want to be mothers these days. That's really fascinating. It's mind-bending, it's mind-blowing how the greatest team in the universe, the greatest team in the universe is men and women, without a doubt, with no hesitation, and with no clear second. It's sort of like how Wayne Gretzky was, I don't know if he still is, but he was for a time, I think he still is, the greatest athlete in the history of the world, because he is so far ahead of the second place person in terms of goals scored that there's no comparison. You know, the fastest runner might be a few percent, maybe a percent or two faster than the second fastest runner, but Wayne Gretzky is off the charts with regards to that. And the greatest team in the history of the known universe is the human male and the human female. We have produced a brilliance, a scintillating, revolving disco ball of spraying thoughts, conclusions, ideas, arguments, concepts, and beliefs that has no second. We're not more animal. We're not animal plus. We're like a different being altogether, which is why people think, of course, that the animals were created by God to serve humans, that humans are created by God with a soul, because it really is our only way of conceiving just how staggeringly and mind-bendingly different we are from animals. And to me, really, one of the worst insults that you can give or receive as a human being is to say that you're acting like an animal. That is like a singer with the most beautiful voice doing a concert and purposefully singing badly and off-key. Be wretched. Be wretched. The greatest team in the universe that will ever be, because as we talked about in the last show, the odds of us being visited by space aliens or visiting space aliens are extraordinarily low. You know, if we didn't live in a world of pedants, if we didn't live in a world of pedants, I would say the odds are zero. So, well, it's not totally impossible. It's like, yeah, well, you could conceivably blindfold yourself. I mean, don't, but you could conceivably blindfold yourself and try and drive to work. Well, it's not zero chance you'd arrive there safely. It's like, yeah, it's zero. But no, you can't prove it's not zero. Yeah, yeah, it's zero. I mean, once in a billion, blah, 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 right? I mean, technically, you could be in a room and you could asphyxiate. Why? Because the random Brownian motion of the air could take all the air, all the oxygen, to the top part or even through the walls, and then you'd be left with no air. This could happen once every 20 universes to one person, one time, one place. You say, well, it's not technically impossible. Yeah, but it's impossible. I mean, try that as an argument in a court of law. So we are the greatest team in the known universe, and given that the known universe is almost certainly going to remain just our solar system, we're never going to meet a better team, males and females. What we have done to create this absolutely glorious couple pounds of tiny, localized, yet infinite wetware known as the human brain is a feat beyond comprehension, and it's so recent. It's only Bronze Age, 3,000 years, 3,000 to 6,000 years ago, like we've had staggering evolution. Just in the last 3,000 to 6,000 years, we've gained a full standard deviation of intelligence. Well, until recently, the most amazing team produces the most amazing brain. And then, recently, relatively recently, really over the last, the last baby boom, somewhat artificial, of course, because it came after the Second World War, from 1945 to 1965 was the baby boom. Average 3, 4, sometimes more kids. There's still a baby boom among the Amish. And I think among the fundamentalist Jews. But that was the last baby boom. And then the scurvy 70s, the materialist 80s, the nihilist 90s, the astroturfed post-9/11 nationalism of the early noughties, and then the reactive chaos of the 20-teens, wherein my public persona was forged and battled and overcome. And women now, in general, overall, young women in particular, well, they don't really want to have babies. Amazing. Amazing. And it's something to really ponder. Now, of course, there's lots of reasons. I get all of that. Lots of reasons. And we've talked about all of those. But I'd like to delve into something much more fundamental today. Because Mother's Day is a beautiful day. A great mother is really one of the greatest treasures in the universe. I mean, it's good to be a good father. I think I'm a good father. But a great mother is the greatest treasure in the universe. A nurturer, an organizer, somebody with community spirit, somebody who brings meaning to the world. Men work for meaning, and meaning is largely provided by mothers. Men have this vast power to create excess value, and that excess value is transferred to women and children, and women and children, and mothers in particular, create meaning. When a man is bone tired, bone weary, exhausted by the strife and conflict and physical battle of squeezing, drilling, yanking, pulling, tearing resources from an indifferent and unfriendly world, battling bureaucracy, battling office politics, battling his own nature, his own tiredness, because extracting resources from a cold and unfriendly world is a brutal business. It was a brutal business. And when a man is tired to his bone marrow and doesn't feel like he has the strength to go on, he comes down the stairs and he sees his wife chasing his children around the kitchen table and pretending to flick them with a tea towel. And the children are laughing so hard that the orange juice is coming out of their nose. Well, he gets a tad refreshed and renewed, and his soul settles into its thorny seat of near infinite productivity, and he says, ah, yes, 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 although I am tired, although my very bones ache in the face of gravity, although I am weary as though my veins were filled with wet sand, this is what it's for. This is what it's for. And the meaning that is reserved for the vast majority of humanity manifests in his eyes in the beauty of a family moment that he will look back upon on his deathbed and smile and say, oh, yeah, that's what it was all for. That's what it was all for. When he wakes in the morning and his wonderful wife is tired, and she says, oh, your son was up at night. He was unwell. I wanted you to sleep. I can take a nap later. I know you've got a big day of work. I wanted you to sleep, so I took care of him. And he goes and sees his son sleeping peacefully with a slightly damp cloth of flannel on his forehead. And he goes and kisses his wife, and he says, I love you so much. Thank you so much for taking such wonderful care of our children. You are absolutely beautiful for it. And whatever I can do to help out, I will. That's the greatest treasure. That's what we do things for. It's what we do it all for, really, foundationally. I battle the world, and it is a weary business at times. Sometimes it's exciting, sometimes it's cool, sometimes I land some blows, a lot of blows are landed in return, obviously. But once you have kids, what do you do it for? You do it for your kids. You do it because you have a child or children who are going to have to make their way in the world, and you want to do your very best to make the world the best place through which to make their way, whatever you can. We burn our present for the sake of the future. I have burnt my reputation to the ground for the sake of the future, which is really the job of the philosopher. I judge myself not by the hysterical reactions of malevolent online trolls, Wikipedia, but I judge myself according to universal principles. My conscience is not beholden to evil doers and evil sayers. My conscience is beholden to universal principles. For me, listening to most people is like listening to someone who says, yeah, it's a 30-foot drop. You can do it. It's fine. Just jump. Just jump. Come on, jump. What are you, chicken? Nope. It's a big drop. I'm not doing that. I'm going to make my decisions according to the universal principles of physics and gravity, not your sadistic, yapping, yawping, boring, droning, catcalling tones. But, although a great mother is the greatest treasure in the universe, and although married women with children are by far the happiest women, because children and eternity and the continuance of life replenishes us in ways that nothing else can. When I was battling the world, rolling on the ground and playing with my daughter when she was little was the greatest restorative imaginable. Give a man a why, he can bear almost any how, and our children are the why. And the how is, how do we best fight evil to create a better world for our children, or at least make it less worse? Children, parenthood, and in particular motherhood, I chose an absolutely wonderful mother for my child, for our child. I will not sing her praises today, because I sing her praises every day, but she is remarkable and wonderful and really, and I'm sure it's not a total accident, the polar opposite of the mother who raised me. The mother who raised my child is the complete opposite of the mother who raised me. Clear-eyed, rational, affectionate, good-natured, funny, warm, thoughtful. And a woman, you know, it's a funny thing that I think a lot of us have, that we have our own secret space, we have our own identity, we have our own thoughts, and then we view the imposition of others into our own secret thoughts as a diminishment of herself. My wife has taught me something enormously different and really quite the opposite, that thinking continually about others is the greatest manifestation of identity known to man. Like, we don't have this identity, which is then diminished by thinking of others. Like we have a pile of food and we give it to others and then we have less food. No, that's not how it works. The giving is the getting. Because when you think of others and they think of you, it's better. Imagine being one man trying to build a giant rocket. He would never get it done. I pencil, right? You know that not one man knows how to make a pencil. Imagine being one man trying to build a giant rocket. Could never do it. But a team can build the rocket. Everything you see around you that is manifested, that is man-made, is made by a team. And if a man wants to build a rocket, or a phone, or a house, all by himself, including getting all the source materials, and cutting down all the trees, and getting the sand and grit for the concrete, and all them milking the glass, by him getting the sand for the glass, he can't do it. Are you diminished by participating with others? No. Everything that you achieve is a manifestation of teamwork. civilization, art, technology, and children. Thinking of others and having them think of you is the greatest manifestation of identity. Why? Because we're social animals. To be atomized, to be individualistic alone, to be isolated, is inhuman. There is no I in humanity. There is only we. We is fun. We is we. See? Now you're participating in bad philosophy jokes. Like it or not. Well, I guess you could turn it off if you want. I mean, particularly as a predator species, we only see in front of us, we can't see behind. So we need others to watch our back. We have a consciousness that is great, that is capable of great and deep concentration. And that means other people have to watch our back while we work. I mean, just think of spinning sticks to start a fire. You've got to really concentrate on that. Know when to blow, know when to wait, look for the spark. And somebody's got to watch our back to make sure some predator doesn't creep up on us when we are concentrating on starting a fire. Or when we're hunting. A man goes to hunt solo in the woods. It's dangerous because while he's concentrating on the hunt, some animal could be concentrating on him. While he is hunting the deer, the wolves are creeping up and hunting him, and he needs people to watch his back. And my wife has taught me that thinking of others and merging my identity with a group is the greatest manifestation of identity and ego, because we do not have single solitary egos. We are a social animal. We merge. This is not collectivism, because I'm not saying that the group has rights over the individual. I'm not creating superior moral concepts. I'm just talking about the way that our brains are. We overlap with others. And to think that your identity or my identity are diminished by thinking about and working with others is the result of pure propaganda. That other groups in society, they get to work together, but particularly white males, of course, we all know this one these days. White males are supposed to be atomized individuals and can't work together. And boy, if you work with other people, if you think about other people, that diminishes you. Like these horrible women, what is it with women and cars and ranting? These horrible women are like, I've been a mother for 20 years and all I ever do is think of other people and nobody ever thinks of me. I mean, my wife says that she wakes up in the morning, she thinks of me, she thinks of our daughter, she thinks of close friends, how to make their lives better. And it's a beautiful thing. And she's really taught me that that's where the real happiness and contentment and security and connection in life is. We are not designed to live alone. There is no such thing as an identity that manifests unburdened by the needs, hopes, desires, and preferences of others. Our identities are manifested in thinking of others and having them think of us. Of course, you don't want to spend your whole life thinking of others, slaving for others, and never get any reciprocity. That's wrong. That's bad. I get that's no good. That's no good. I'm not advocating for that. Reciprocity is key. If thinking of others is a virtue, and it is, then having others think of you is also a virtue. But do not imagine that you are diminished by thinking of others and striving to help improve their lives. You are not diminished by that. I am thinking of you, the audience, and trying to communicate in a way that improves your lives. Does that make me less? Has that taken away from me? Has that diminished me? Am I a fixed quantity? And when I hand out words, time, care, thoughts, virtues, and attention to the world, am I diminished? Am I made less virtuous? Less verbose, less myself by giving ideas, arguments, and wisdom to the world? Of course not. I become a better person by verbalizing virtue to the world. It reminds me. It impacts me for the better. I am not losing out in doing this. I am gaining everything. I do not diminish myself by pouring my heart, mind, and soul into the world. What virtues you feed to the world also nourish yourself. And if you hoard your communication and virtues and thoughts and cares and emotions and passions from the world, everything just dies within you. We've all seen it if we're older and we're honest. The people who refuse to participate in the world, the people who refuse to be kind, thoughtful, and generous in the world, it's like hoarding perishable goods. It's a line from my novel, The God of Atheists, where people are making fun of virgins in their 30s, female virgins in their 30s. It's a little coarse, it's a little crass, it's a little cruel, but one of them comments about aging female virgins, the intense guarding of food long rotted. The intense guarding of food long rotted. Now, if you've been around a bunch of exploiters, and some of us were raised in that mindset, if you've been around a lot of exploiters, then you recognize that thinking of others diminishes yourself because they take and take and take and don't think of you back and don't return anything back. But then what you do is you go out into the world, and we've all had this temptation. If we've been raised by exploiters, we go out into the world and say, I gotta hoard, I gotta hold on, I gotta keep the stuff. I gotta guard. People are gonna take and never give anything back. Now, if people take and don't give anything back, then yes, thinking of others diminishes you, for sure. For sure. For sure. If you go to the grocery store and you pay them $100 and they don't give you any groceries, well then, by golly, you're down $100. I get that that's bad, and then don't go to that grocery store. Don't be around people who don't reciprocate. But when they do reciprocate, you're in heaven. You're in heaven. And if you go out into the world and you treat people as if they're exploitive abusers, you end up forever and ever alone. Amen. Now, why don't women really want to be mothers these days? Why are they so easy to propagandize into antinatalism? It seems kind of counterintuitive, doesn't it? And then I'll give you my theory. I'm happy to hear your thoughts. I would say it goes a little something like this. Women have a sex drive and maternal instincts. Now, having a high sex drive for men and for women is a way of guaranteeing that children will be born. Again, evolutionarily speaking, there was no way to avoid procreative sex without procreation. I mean, there were sheep's bladder condoms and other sorts of things throughout history, but if you want to put your dick in a sheep's innards before it goes into a woman, I can only say that you come from a culture that is fairly foreign to the West, to put it as nicely as possible. It's bad. So, nature evolved a high sex drive in order to guarantee that there would be children. Now, let's look at how tribes operated throughout history. Tribes operated on irrational, narcissistic, vainglorious lies. My tribe is infinitely better than your tribe. My tribe has been chosen by God to rule over your tribe. The gods are on my side. We're better. You're bad. My team is better. My culture is better. My history is better. My habits and practices and music is better. Blah, blah, blah. And all of that's fairly irrational. It's hard to look back throughout human history at the scurvy, constant battle and overturning and wars and say, oh, there's one better than the other. I mean, imagine going back to fights among the Aborigines in Australia 40,000 years ago, or to the various battles occurring among the indigenous populations of North or Central or South America, and say, well, these guys were good, they're virtuous, these guys are bad. And right, I mean, certainly the Aztecs were perceived as pretty bad by the local population in Central America, because South America, because they all joined with Cortez and his couple hundred Spaniards. It wasn't like a couple hundred Spaniards took down the entire Aztecs, but hundreds of thousands of local tribes joined together with the Spanish to take down the Aztecs, because the Aztecs were, I mean, obviously vicious and evil and cruel, but it wasn't like all the other tribes were noble and heroic and virtuous and moral and understood property rights and the non-aggression principle and things like that. It was like sports teams. I mean, each sports team wants to win, but it's not like one is virtuous and one is bad. They always try and join these two things together in movies, right? Movies are like, well, the Karate Kid is good, but that other guy is just a real bully. It's bad. It's a battle of good versus evil. That's what they always say, right? The Japanese historically thought they were wonderful and noble and virtuous and dominant. Well, they were dominant in a lot of ways, and they were just, I mean, evil as a whole. I mean, there's a reason why in South Korea they cheered when Oppenheimer's bomb went off over Hiroshima. the rape of Nanking, the torture of the South African, Australian, and sometimes American prisoners of war. Vicious stuff. So each tribe thought it was superior. And how was that superiority transmitted to the children? Well, culture, generally, is transmitted by mothers and enforced by males. Now, can you implant narcissistic superiority in your children if you deeply love them and love the truth? Nope, you can't. You have to say, we're the greatest, which, you know, everyone knows deep down is, I mean, for almost all of human history, is pretty much a lie. You have to say, well, no, we're the greatest. We're chosen by God. We're superior. We're the best. We're the, right? Say all of that to your kids. And why do you say that? Well, you say that because if you don't say that as a mother, you'll be ostracized by the other mothers. If you're deeply ensconced in a very religious group and you say, well, I love truth and I love my children and I don't want to inflict my beliefs upon them, I want to ask them and reason through things together, then you will very quickly be kicked out of that group. Because the other mothers would be like, whoa, 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 shark of truth in the water, kids, get out of the water, get to the beach, the shark of truth is chomping out there. Run! Swim! Someone is questioning whether we're automatically the best. Someone is questioning whether ghosts are real. Someone is questioning the irrationality that binds us all together and makes us a disciplined unit, a brutal survival. There are questions, and culture is anti-rational answers, and the questions are hunting the culture. And if you let, and listen, I sympathize. I really do sympathize. Because if you let the questions hunt the culture and win, the culture disintegrates, the cohesion disintegrates, and then you end up being taken over by people who more effectively brutalize and inflict lies upon their children. I get that. I'm not a fool. I understand that rational, empirical, philosophical curiosity, I mean, if it gave advantages to tribes, it wouldn't be so universally hated and attacked by tribes. I get brutal child abuse, neglect, irrational infliction of false narratives. We're good because we wear blue. They're evil because they wear red. It has obviously a survival metric. And I mean, we can see this playing out in the West. We've got groups who are in-group preference, and then we have groups who are universalists, right? Generally, the Greco-Roman Christians, Europeans, and so on tend to be universalists. Other cultures tend to be more in-group preference. I get all of that. It just, for me, it's truth or bust. It's truth or bust. To just be another petty tribalist fighting endless, pointless wars against other petty tribalists, I mean, not worth it. We have to get to the truth, and if it doesn't happen this cycle of history, but we lay the foundation for the next cycle of history, we gotta strive for better, we gotta strive for more, we gotta strive to become human rather than just hyper-cunning, cultural apes, beasts. So, for mothers, you got a very strong sex drive, as do men, and that gets you the kids. Now, if you truly love your kids, and in the way that I talk about love, love is our involuntary response to virtue if we're virtuous, then you want to teach your kids rational virtues and consistent integrity and ethics and thinking for themselves and reasoning and so on, right? Now, if you were to teach your children those philosophical values and virtues, you will be almost immediately ostracized by the other mothers and the fathers. And then your children won't have anyone to date and mate with, and that bloodline ends. So you have to have, as a mother, hostility to your children's independent reason in order to ensure their genetic survival. In other words, you have to hate their curiosity and truth and love their compliance and subjugation to the irrational cultural absolutes or anti-rational cultural absolutes. So you have to hate their independence and rational thought, and you have to withhold affection from them unless they comply with your irrational absolutes. So, parents are not evolved to deeply love and respect and treasure independent rational thought in their children. We have evolved to inflict anti-rational cultural absolutes on our children. And what that means is that, as a parent, and as a mother in particular, because this stuff is all hardwired in when we're young, or softwired in, I should say. Hardwired is being born, but softwired in is the cultural absolutes. As a mother, you have to be brutally willing to withhold affection from your children until they comply. You know, the scene, the famous scene, O'Brien and Winston Smith in 1984. The party tells you how many fingers it's holding up, and we will punish you until not only do you say whatever number the party tells you, but you believe it. Well, this is an example of how culture is inflicted upon the young. It's one of the reasons why that scene is so powerful. And cultural absolutes were inflicted upon Eric Blair, who is George Orwell, of course, when he was a kid. If you read his essay on boarding school, and the same thing was done to me in boarding school, though I'm sure slightly less brutally than him, who was in boarding school decades before I was. I'm sure it was even harsher back when Eric Blair was going. So you cannot unconditionally love your children as a mother. You have to conditionally love them or provide affection when they comply, withhold affection or punish them when they don't comply, and that way you train them in the absolute anti-rationality of cultural absolutes that are necessary for their survival in an amoral world. Now, if you say to women, well, you got to be nicer as parents. You can't just brutalize your children to inflict cultural absolutes upon them, because that's been more the norm over the last, you could argue that it really started with, Dickens popularized the idea that we should be more sensitive and thoughtful towards children. He was a writer, of course, kind of a brutal man himself, and not a great father, to put it mildly, but he did write, for the first time in human history, he really wrote sensitively about the experience of society from a child's perspective, and was a huge turning point in the history of the West, and was so popular because people remember what it was like to be brutalized as children. Please, sir, can I have some more? So, women, of course, want to have sex. Sex leads to children. And then they have to be willing to be brutally cold towards their children, or their children will not survive. They have to brutally train their children in cultural absolutes, anti-rational, non-empirical. We're the best, they're the worst, blah, blah, blah. Our God, your God. Our songs are beautiful. Their songs are just noise. Our dances are beautiful. Their dances are just jumping around. Our religion is the best. Their religion is the worst. Ours is the truth. Theirs is falsehood. Our prophet is real. Their prophet is a false prophet. Blah, blah, blah. Yeah, all of that, right? And if they don't inflict these anti-rational cultural absolutes on their children will not survive, will not flourish, will not reproduce, will not be successful. They have to. Which means that the maternal instinct of protecting children, evolutionarily speaking, means being incredibly harsh to children who don't swallow the jagged pill of anti-rational cultural absolutes. To love your children means to hurt your children. To love your children means to neglect, be cold, to hit, to scream, to yell. And of course, we all know this, right? And I've talked to people for decades about their childhoods, and we kind of know the cliche of the exasperated, stressed out, screaming mom, because she's desperate for her children to survive. And throughout most of human evolution, that survival meant swallowing, internalizing, and ending up believing a bunch of nonsense that's easily disprovable with 5 seconds or 10 seconds of rational thought or empirical evidence. To go against the dictates of reason and evidence is required for the children to survive, and therefore she cannot unconditionally love her children as they are. She must be willing, at the drop of a hat, to punish, attack, scream at, and even brutalize her children in order to get them to fall in line with the cultural absolutes required for them to date and mate and reproduce. So, women cannot love motherhood, and men cannot love fatherhood, but it's Mother's Day, so we're talking about that. Women cannot love motherhood because motherhood involves, evolutionarily speaking, historically speaking, and of course in a lot of cultures around the world now, and I'm not talking about non-European cultures, I mean in the European cultures, the mothers are brutally inflicting the woke stuff on their kids, particularly their daughters. And what's happened is, of course, women teach their daughters how to appeal to resource providers. Because with sex drives, women are going to get, they're going to have sex, they're going to get pregnant, young women, and they need resource providers. So mothers are programmed to teach their daughters how to appeal to resource providers. Now, resource providers used to be males. Now it's governments. So mothers are teaching their children how to appeal to resource providers. And that means being leftist, being woke, because that appeals to the government, particularly single mothers survive from the government, and therefore they teach their daughters to be pleasing to the government. It's a hack, it's a hardwired thing. So, evolutionarily speaking, historically speaking, mothers have to brutalize their children into conformity with anti-rational absolutes, which means they have to be pretty nasty, pretty hostile, pretty broken, pretty distant, willing to turn affection on and off to help program their children and say, well, right now you need me for survival, so you have to please me, and if you don't please me, I will mess you up. And that's because in the future you have to please the tribe or you will not survive. The price of gaining the protection of the tribe is subjugating yourself to the irrational absolutes of the tribe. Sorry, evolution wins. That's what we got to do. So do women love being mothers? Well, you can't. Evolutionarily speaking, you have to have your children survive. That's the evolutionary absolute. And to have your children survive, you have to harm them. Because you can't reason them into anti-rational cultural absolutes. The cult of culture. You can't reason people any more than you can reason people on a sports team into thinking that they're moral and all the other sports teams are evil. You can't reason people into that. I mean, they try that again with art. But you have to brutalize your children and violate their minds in order to have them survive and gain the protection of the tribe through subjugation to the tribal absolutes. And unless you're a sadist, which not many people are, you're not going to be very happy or you're not going to enjoy it very much brutalizing your children. That if your children do something that might displease the tribe in the future, you hit them, yell at them, scream at them, punish them, withhold food from them, or freeze them out through neglect, which is really terrifying for children, because without parental affection and resources, they can't survive at all. So neglect is a death threat to children. I'm not kidding about that. That's not hyperbole. Neglect is a death threat for children. So do women enjoy being mothers? Well, I don't think so, because motherhood, evolutionarily speaking, was regularly brutalizing children to get them to discard reason and evidence and conform with tribal absolutes. We see this all over. This is not theoretical. We see this all over the place in the world, right? Children of this religion believe this religion. Children of that religion believe that religion. Children from this location believes this location is full of all these wonderful people and other locations are full of terrible people and the other locations believe the same. Right? We get it, right? We get it. I'm not even criticizing that. I mean, we evolved from brutal animals. Chimpanzees wage war of territory and resource holding against each other, right? It's the natural state of nature is unreasoning, bloody dominance. So we've got to evolve out of that. We got to be clear about what's happening. So there are things that women really enjoy. Travel seems to be a big one. Travel, being attractive to men. Now, people don't generally understand that being attractive to men is a turn on for women. Of course, it should be, right? Got to please the resource providers. because you're going to have kids, and kids can't survive without the resource. We've got to please the resource providers, right? So for women, it's a turn-on to be attractive to men, and now women have the kind of male attention that was normally reserved for Helen of Troy in the past. I mean, I was in a school of maybe 2,000 kids, maybe 2,500 kids, and there was one it girl. I still remember her name. There was one it girl, and I even remember this in boarding school. In boarding school, we were segregated, males and females. We still knew who the it girl was. I can still pick her out. I got a photo somewhere of myself in boarding school when I was 6. I can still pick out the it girl. And so the it girl got attention from, like, I don't know, 1,000 guys. I mean, some gay guys in there, some asexual guys or whatever. So she would get attention from like 800 to 1,000 guys. You know, average 3 days on Hinge. So every girl now gets the sexual excitement of being the it girl. Every girl is the it girl because every girl can get attention from hundreds or thousands of males in any given week. That's fun. Travel is fun. Materialism is fun. Consuming is fun. Buying is fun. Thrifting is fun. Having guys pursue you is fun. Going on dates is fun. Motherhood, is it fun? And this is not to say, oh, it's shallow and frivolous. I'm not saying any of that. It's just that travel, materialism, being attractive, going on dates, all of that is fun. And women instinctively know that if they become mothers, they're going to face a lot of conflict. In the past, there really wasn't that much conflict, right? If you were raised in among the Amish, then as a mother, you would simply inflict the Amish values or whatever. It could be any group or culture or religion. You can inflict the Amish values on your kids, and your kids are then going to be accepted by the other parents, and they're going to be Amish, and right, not that much conflict now. Multiculturalism and also the new atheism and libertarianism and wokeism. Now, it's just, you're going to run into conflicts no matter what. In the past, parenting was more fun because you had absolute authority over instructing your children. And you could tell them, we're the good, they're the bad, without any particular conflict because you were ensconced or enmeshed within a tribe, didn't have contact with other tribes, other belief systems, other virtues and values. So you could do all of that. Now, I mean, if you're conservative, you're going to send your kid to public school, they're going to be hit with all of the woke brain rot. If you're woke, then heaven forbid your sons get online, hit the manosphere, and get enmeshed in opinions that go contrary to your own. And women, as a whole, have evolved to escalate punishment and coldness in order to get conformity, but that's because they had a monopoly. And they knew for absolute certain that without that monopoly, without that uniformity, their children wouldn't survive, wouldn't reproduce. They don't have that anymore, which is very stressful for women. Which is why mothers tend to yell, scream, escalate, get cold. I saw this video of this mother who had to buy a $157 lock to put on the bathroom because her son kept messing up the bathroom, and he wouldn't listen, and he wouldn't clean it, and it was vile in there. I can't even bend the towels. And he wouldn't listen, he wouldn't clean it up. Later, Mom, later. I'll do it later, Mom. And so she ended up buying a lock, exasperated, frustrated. Women are designed, mothers are designed, to brutalize their children's rational integrity in order to give them the chance of surviving and reproducing in a monocultural belief system. When you get all of this multicultural stuff and opposing beliefs, women get increasingly desperate and frustrated because they feel a very strong urge to have their children conform to them for reasons of survival, which we can all view as honorable or at least as necessary, which is, you know, we had to develop to the point where we have honor, and to do that, we had to develop out of necessity. Necessity is the foundation, right? Necessary but not sufficient for honor. So women are really frustrated, really tense, especially if they are raising sons without fathers, right? Without husbands. Because, I mean, I'll just be brutally honest. I thought about this last night and I thought, oh, should I talk about it in the show tomorrow? And I'm like, yeah, what? Sure. Why not? And maybe this is just my experience. I don't think it's just my experience. And you can certainly let me know what you think. But it's kind of tough to be disciplined by a mother when you get into your teenage years, because you get pretty hulking. I mean, I'm almost 6 foot tall, 190 pounds, not much fat. And when I was a teenager, I was on every sports team known to man. I did squash, badminton, cross-country running, water polo, swim team. I just did all the sports, baseball, soccer, loved it. And I was, you know, pretty, I wasn't like a big muscular guy. I wasn't like doing weights. I know, actually, I started doing weights in my teens. There's a picture of me doing weights in my teens on my balcony. And so I was, you know, my mom is all of a buck five dripping wet. And it just, to submit to someone you're way bigger than, just goes against the male grain. It just does. It just does. We hate doing it. We don't want to do it. We won't do it. And so you fight. You submit when you're smaller, but when your mom is wagging her finger up at your nose rather than down at your forehead, it's just a whole different power dynamic. Doesn't really happen with the fathers as much. It's really hard as a boy, as a young man, as a teenager, to take orders from someone you could very easily ignore physically. Just doesn't make any sense. It's like seeing, you know, one of those hulking grade 12 kids be bullied and pushed around by some 70-pound kid in grade 6. It just doesn't, that's not what happens. It just doesn't make sense. So are women enjoying motherhood, given their programming, given what is necessary, given the coldness and cruelty that is evolutionarily being needed for their children's survival, and given that the only way to survive multiculturalism is through rationality? I'm working on a whole documentary on this at the moment, and if you do want to help out the show, freedomain.com/donate, I really would appreciate it. I really would appreciate it. The only way to survive multiculturalism is through rationality. Because when you had a monopoly on culture, which we evolved to have, then kids really weren't doing things very different from your kids. Well, so-and-so across the street, he's allowed to play on this day. No, this day is a holy day. We can't play, but he's allowed to, right? Whereas if every kid is not playing on the holy day, then it's a whole lot easier to maintain. It's stressful, man. It's brutal for moms out there, and fathers too, but again, it's Mother's Day. So I'm saying this with sympathy. So why don't women want to become mothers? Well, because there's not enough reason in the world for them to reason with their children, and it goes against the grain. Not because women are irrational, but because all tribes were anti-rational, and women had to inflict that anti-rationality on kids in order for their kids to survive. That's what they're programmed to do. So why is hedonism replacing, quote, self-sacrifice? Because women don't have answers as to how to be a mother in a multicultural environment. I mean, again, men don't really either, so, but we're just talking about Mother's Day, we're talking about the mothers. I say this with sympathy. Women are programmed to take in stray children. And when they hear refugee, migrant, fleeing, global warming, they want to take them in. Sure. Because in a tribe, within a tribe, you know, women would die in childbirth or get an infection or die or something like that, and kids would be astray. You've got to take them in. I write about this in my novel, Just Poor. The main character is left on a doorstep by a passing tinker, and in an unimaginably harsh world, she's just taken in. You just take in people. And it works within the same cultural environment. It's much less challenging when extended to perhaps hostile cultures and environments. So it's not that, oh, women are just shallow and they just want to travel and sip coffees in the shadow of the Champs-Élysées. No, they're just, it's becoming progressively frustrating and difficult and impossible to become a mother without reason and in a multicultural environment. Because your kid is going to be exposed to a bunch of kids doing things completely differently. What do you say? Which is why women have gone from judge harshly to don't judge. And women tend to, I mean, for reasons of obvious evolutionary survival, tend to comply with the most aggressive. And this is why women often have more sympathy to more aggressive cultures and less sympathy for more reasonable cultures. Again, we're just looking at the evolution. This is not a blame situation or scenario. It's not a judgment situation or scenario. We're just looking at the dominoes and the cause and effect. So the only chance we have, really, is reason. It's philosophy. There's a reason why I'm doing all of this. The only chance we have is reason. Objectivity. Again, this is core of the documentary I've been working on for the last while on rational ethics. I've got about 23 minutes done so far. It's a lot of slog, but it's worth it. It's worth it. It's reason robust, man. Reason has to become robust, or aggression and anti-rationality are going to win. And given the modern technology, they will win for how long? Well, a long, long time. I remember being chilled. Some science fiction book or some book I was reading was talking about the imaginary future of the party in 1984, saying their 9,000-year rule. Could be. Technology, you can't put it back in the bag. So, happy Mother's Day, everyone. I hope this is helpful. I hope this makes sense. And I sympathize with women out there, and I sympathize with them not wanting to become mothers. Now, there are cultures, of course, where women aren't becoming mothers that are more monocultural. Of course, you can think of one of the lowest birth rates, I think at a 0.8 or 0.7, or even lower, perhaps. I'm not sure of the latest data. South Korea. South Korea is largely mono-ethnic, monocultural. But women don't love being mothers, because if you love being a mother and you are uniformly positive and helpful towards your children, then you won't be able to brutalize them in the way that your culture demands for them to reproduce. So it's not just the multicultural stuff, I think, that accelerates it, but it is also women do not enjoy motherhood. Because if women only enjoy motherhood and are uniformly positive towards their children will not be brutalized to the point where they can reproduce in an anti-rational culture, of which all cultures are anti-rational. If it's rational, it's not culture. It's just fact, truth, reason, evidence, science, whatever. Philosophy. So multiculturalism does accelerate this process to some degree. But even in monocultures, mono-ethnic situations, women don't innately enjoy motherhood. If you look at, let's say, conservative Christian women have more kids, it would be a couple of generations, the woke people would die out, which is why they need to import people. But conservative Christian women have a lot more kids. And why? Well, it's a commandment from God, and they tend to stay in conservative Christian circles where the coldness that they have towards religious skepticism on the part of their children, and in particular their sons, you will not survive without my approval. And if you don't obey my anti-rational absolutes, I will withhold or withdraw my approval until you comply. It's a brutal process. And you could say, yes, well, you know, but you take your kids to the dentist and they don't like that, and but it's for the best. I get all of that. But you can explain to the kids the dentistry stuff. You know, bacteria live on your teeth and they attack your enamel and you get cavities and blah, blah, blah. It's very bad and so on, right? So you can explain all of that in a rational way. So I want to sort of address a good counter argument would be, you say it's multiculturalism, but what about mono-ethnic societies like Japan and South Korea and other places? Their birth rates have collapsed as well. It's like, oh, sure, sure. But we said to mothers, stop being brutal. Okay, but we haven't given them reason yet. We haven't given them reason. Peaceful parenting in the absence of UPB is an anti-natalist policy, because we haven't given mothers the tools to teach their children right and wrong from a rational standpoint. And so they end up just getting stressed and tensed and kind of screechy. And again, I say this with great sympathy. I mean, if I was half my size and had to dominate someone twice my size, I'd probably be a little screechy too. There's a reason why I did UPB before peaceful parenting. I did UPB almost 20 years ago, peaceful parenting a year or two ago, because you have to give people the moral tools with which to instruct their children. And that's part of what my new documentary is about, is how to teach kids ethics. And I did this many years ago with a show called The ABCs of UPB, how to teach ethics, rational ethics to kids. But peaceful parenting or gentle parenting or unparenting, whatever, right? In the absence of rational ways to teach ethics to children, it just ends up kind of chaotic and feral. I mean, it would be like saying to someone, would you like to take in a dog as a newborn, a puppy, and you can never discipline it, and you can never teach it how to behave? Well, most people would say, well, no, that's just going to be kind of chaotic. I don't want that, right? So I think this is one of the reasons why women are avoiding motherhood is they deeply and instinctively understand that they don't have any good tools to teach right and wrong. The brutality and manipulation of the past, which was necessary for our survival, and that's fine, that's no longer allowed or approved of. And you've got to be sweet and nice and gentle and sweetie, we don't do that. And right, how does that work with a teenage boy? Well, it doesn't. There's a lot of frustration out there. I do watch these videos. And again, I know it's not exactly representative, but the birth rate is a pretty absolute metric. So this is another reason why I'm working on this documentary. I don't know what it's going to be called yet, other than Our Last Best Hope, perhaps. Maybe Our Last Best Hope. All right. So those are my thoughts on Mother's Day, and I thank you guys so much for dropping by. I hope that this was a helpful talk. But there are ways to teach your children. There are ways to teach your children how to be good without brutality. In fact, really, the only way to teach your children to be good is without brutality. All right. Well, I'm going to stop here. I really do appreciate everyone's thoughts and comments. Well, thoughts today, comments in the future, and happy Mother's Day to everyone. If you embrace UPB, Universally Preferable Behavior, if you embrace peaceful parenting, you can have a wonderful time as a mother. Part of my wife's beautiful experiences as a mother is because we can teach our daughter ethics without punishment, reward, manipulation. It's wonderful. So this is the lab for the future. At least that's my experience. Have yourself a wonderful, wonderful day, my friends. freedomain.com/donate to help out the show. You know the rest. We'll talk to you soon. Lots of love. Bye.